I'm Norma Everest from Wartburg Seminary, and a number of you have been here all week, and for others of you, this is the first time, and some have been here 2-3 days, and so on. So what we try to do is somehow gather threads together and yet begin with a new topic. Today the topic actually is not living together as women and men, but learning together as women and men. And maybe the two are, maybe the word really doesn't make that much difference, whichever one it is. But it certainly is related to the topic we've had all week, and that is the adult in the Christian learning community. And certainly it has to do with the definition of adult. Last year in my class was a woman from Namibia, and as we talked about women and men and oppressed and oppressor and all of that kind of thing, she said, In my country, blacks are not allowed to grow up. Blacks are not allowed to be adults. And of course, that's true. And one of the obvious reasons is because there are more blacks than whites in Namibia. And the whites illegally are in control of the country. And if indeed the blacks were allowed to even think of themselves as adults, it would be quite dangerous for the white oppressor who thinks that they ought to be able to rule because somehow they are superior. So the whole concept of oppressed and oppressor, of keeping some people childlike, is rather a significant one, and one that we really can't ignore. There's also another sense in which the whole concept of adulthood and teacher-learner relates to the male-female concept, and that is that when the other day we put on the board concepts of the adult and talked about the adult as producer, you learn as a child and then you grow up and are an adult and are a productive member of society with the strength behind those words. So by definition, or at least by that definition of adulthood, an adult isn't supposed to need to learn anymore. To need to learn is to be less than adequate, and perhaps for a while one could go back for retraining. But only for a while. The end result is that you don't need to learn, that you are an adult. And all week we've been struggling with, and I think productively struggling with, the concept of adulthood and learner being able to coincide. Certainly I believe it is biblical, and certainly New Testament, that God wants us to grow up into full manhood, into full personhood, anthropos, so that we can be all that we can be. And at the same time, the New Testament is full of the whole thing of continuing to learn and grow. And one of the concepts of andragogy, as we've talked today, adult learning, is the mutuality or interdependence. And that's certainly New Testament. Growing and knit together as the body of Christ. Growing and learning and being more and more interdependent is, I think, very clearly the New Testament message. And the New Testament freedom. We've also said this week clearly that we are freed from subservience to servanthood, from slavery, and we talked about in that relationship to vocatio, to servanthood. And at that very point is the growing edge, is the learning opportunity, learning what that is to be. Well, as far as ramifications, come up here. There's a couple seats up here by me. Come on. Yeah, come up here. Certainly, if all of those things are true, we see that the ramifications of that in our congregations, it is easier for women to go to Bible class. And that's not just because they have free time to do it. Women and men are equally busy in our society. But again, by definition of what it's okay to be, society's definition, it is okay for women still to be learners. Now, with that goes the other side. Women are never supposed to fully have learned it all. So there's something at stake in continuing to be the dependent learner asking the authority for the answers. And sometimes we've confused all of Christianity as that, somehow to remain childlike. That's not Pauline, is it? Paul wants, and all of the New Testament writers and ministers, want us to grow up into full personhood and into interdependence. There's also something very mysterious and very interesting about women learning together. And our churches historically had been full of women learning together, the women's circle. The other day we alluded to Sarah's circle. And even though I think we went through a period in which we said maybe the circles are old-fashioned, there's still something very powerful about that circle, whether it was a sewing circle or a circle for biblical study in more recent years. It was a place where somehow men weren't supposed to go. By definition of maleness, manhood. But also was kind of uncomfortable. Yesterday we chuckled around here because we had one man in our group and we acknowledged that and how even though it's difficult for a woman to, quote, break in, notice the violent language there, break into a man's group, it is very difficult, even more difficult perhaps, for a man to enter a woman's group. Because what happens to the male identity? You are, quotes, going down, you are all, you know, all those kinds of things. Again, society definitions. These may or may not be things you experience, but I think they are phenomena in our society. There has sometimes been thought to have power in women being together, and that was a power that could not be acknowledged. A few weeks ago, I was talking with a women's luncheon group. How innocuous can you get? Women's luncheon group in Platteville, Wisconsin. Who's ever heard of Platteville, Wisconsin? Were any of you there? You're close. Okay. Oh. Well, okay, you've been there to get to know. The surprise, of course, is that there was a lot of power in Platteville, Wisconsin. And the room was filled, and we were talking about issues of war and peace and change, and we chuckled. And as I drove up, I realized that the church in Platteville, I didn't know who would be there. You know, guest speaker, you never quite knew who was going to be there. They told me about how many. And it's right next to a home that the Lutheran Church has helped fund for elderly residents. So a lot were walking across with their canes and whatever. And I got a picture kind of quickly as to the age level of the audience. And again, by our society's definition, we've been saying all week, adulthood is a plateau. It is not. It is a plateau. You drop off at the end, are unproductive, are useless, are old, no longer truly person, adult. All those erroneous definitions. But you see, they capture us. And for a moment, I was tempted, as with a competitive thing, to think, oh, it's only old people here today. Okay? Tempted. Well, the power in that room and how those women, and they were almost all women, one male pastor, you know, were geared in and were with it and knew what we had to do in this world. And then we chuckled because he said, there should be news cameras out here. You know, insurrection plan and Platteville luncheon. We're going to say the world should be at peace instead of at war. And the women knew what peace was about. But of course, there was no news coverage because it was merely women at a luncheon talking. And that's New Testament too, of course. It was merely gossip at the open tomb. The disciples could hardly believe the first preaching, the first witness to the center of our life, the risen Lord. It was merely gossip. Merely gossip. Women's talk, women's learning, women's being together has often, well, almost always been met in three ways. One, ignored. You pretend it doesn't exist. Okay. Two, trivialized. Okay, I see some head shaking. Even this morning a bit, you know, a little chuckle after the topic. And three, if it gets powerful and a little out of hand, then ridiculed. Get it back in the box again. With that setup, I think it is very difficult in our society for men and women to learn from each other. At the same time, we do. We learn all the time, and in a few moments we can talk about that. I mean, I'm always learning from my husband, and my husband's always learning from me by virtue of the fact we've lived together 22 years. And it's hard after a while to separate what has learned from whom. That's when a learning community really, really begins to be knit together. But it is difficult by nature of systems in our society for men and women to live together. For one thing, when women are thought to have power, it is often in groups, because one woman alone, oh, I didn't bring it along, but a marvelous piece of how women kill their own words with kindness, that we often, at the end of our phrases, have a question, so that we kind of deny our own authority, we deny our own teaching authority, or the whole teaching field is put in the woman's side, so we, you know, ignore or trivialize the whole area of women. Or when women are together and their power is sensed, they become frightening to men and therefore must either be ignored, trivialized, or ridiculed. What does it mean to be sisters and brothers together in a learning community? I mean, after all, no one wants to be a sissy. I did a study on that word long ago. What does sissy mean, anyway? I saw in the dictionary Sisyphus, some ancient Greek character who had to roll a stone up the hill, and it was always rolling back down. I thought, that sort of feels like me much of the time. But sissy doesn't refer to Sisyphus. Sissy refers to sister. A sissy is a sister. See how even that word has connotations of something you would not want to be. When the women ordained in the Lutheran Church in this country celebrated the 10th anniversary, we gathered in Rochester, Minnesota, and it was the first time those women had been together in one place. Each of us had studied, one here, two there, three there, in different classes, you know, the first ones. And we'd heard about each other, but never had all been together. We came together, 150 or so, a lot of women, and a lot of power. And some of the men who were there visiting, and some of the male church leaders who were there, felt the power, and some who could say it said, there's a lot of power in this room, and it's scary. But you see, the women coming together didn't want to be scary, but it was felt that way, received that way. What was interesting, some of us in Wartburg were sitting kind of down the front row, and the first evening gathering, we were greeted by the male leaders of the three church bodies who had women ordained. And ironically, each one of them, as they kind of gave their welcome and their ad lib address and so on, mentioned an older sister, someone from whom they had first learned. I don't think they planned this at all. I really think it was at a kind of emotional level that it was happening to them. Someone from whom they, as a little boy, had first sensed that women had power. I don't think that in our society men have learned what to do with sisters, particularly bigger sisters. You can't hit a sister. You sure don't want to learn from a bossy sister. What does it mean to deal with sissies, with sisters? Those are important issues. At the same time, I have sensed that men kind of are curious about what goes on when women are together. I belong to a faculty of which all the other members are male, and when we were going to have our first faculty retreat, I'd come from Yale faculty where we had more equal numbers of men and women. Not equal, but there were eight of us women, and that seemed like a lot. But at Wartburg, I was the only one, and I look forward to the retreat because the retreats are neat things. They got together, it was sort of like an extended business meeting. I mean, it wasn't like I had experienced retreats with women or with women and men together. And then it dawned on me why one of the men in particular had been very curious what the women clergy had done when they got together. He really wanted to know. I thought he was just kind of putting on. I assumed he was trivializing. He wasn't. He really wanted to know how women are when they learn from one another, because he couldn't understand it. And I've come to finally figure out that we don't understand each other as men and women. In the last few years, the women students get together because they need each other as a support group. The men students say, hey, maybe can't we have that too? We said, sure, get it together. Well, they kind of needed permission, and they didn't know what to do when they got together. They knew how to play volleyball together, they knew how to compete together, and they knew how to work on a task together. Men in the congregations know how to be the trustees together. And I first thought they were kidding me, but they really wanted to know what to be when they were together. I think it is easier for women when they are together to be mutual learners, because I think it's easier for women to share power. Now, maybe some of you will want to, from your own experience, will want to say something different. I have found that in the male world of higher education, which is predominantly a male world, even the very language is militaristic. You defend a thesis. You hold forth. You debate. You polish your lecture. And as some of my colleagues say, well, put forth your idea and we'll all shoot it down. Missile language, isn't it? Missile language. Penis language, if you will. Okay. Interesting. And I don't learn well in that way. And they say, well, that's the way you must learn if you're going to make it as a professor. That's the way you must teach. And I believe that we're all trapped. Each of us is trapped in some ways. And that there's much at stake in our learning how to learn from one another. Come, there are chairs up here, and we don't mind you coming right up. Please do. No, that's not, don't be sorry at all. Please. Just in the more recent years, I have come to see the connection between feminism and nonviolence, feminism and peace, and militarism and masculinism. Not that all my brothers want to go to war, heaven forbid, no, but that somehow societally, systemically, we have been programmed that way. Pat Schrader, Schroeder? Too German there. Congresswoman said, when men talk about defense, they always claim to be protecting women and children, but they never ask women and children what they think. I think of the banner, war is not healthy for children and other living things. And every time I hear that, somehow we're doing this for the women and children, I cry, no. But there's been kind of a bind with that. Rosemary Ruther had a marvelous article about a year ago in Christian Century, Feminism and Peace, and saying that the ways we live, the ways we learn, the ways, all of these have profound effect. That's why I say living and learning together, maybe those words really are interchangeable, because learning cannot be confined to women and children's world. That maybe they have a profound effect, and what we must be about is teaching and learning a whole new way of living. The feminist movement was very slow to join up with the peace movement, because you see, historically, women have always been for peace and therefore ignored, trivialized, if those were the subjects. So for women to say that they were pacifist was a risky thing, because you weren't really making it in male subject matter. But she says, we must come to grips with that. Contemporary feminists have grown much less sure about the connections between feminism and peace. Although many feminists continue to believe that males tend toward hostility and violence, they are no longer sure that women's mothering role inclines women toward nonviolence. Further, they are sure that women should pursue a peacemaking ethic as an expression of their true emancipated humanity as women. Rather, they suspect that women have become pacified through this ideology of women's pacific nature and thus socialized into be passive victims of male violence. So it gets to be very tricky. True nonviolence must be based, first of all, on a secure sense of one's own value as a human being. So there has to be a sense of freedom, and I think the Christian has this already. We don't have to make it in a male world before we have freedom. A sense of freedom and sense of identity, first. Violence toward others, far from being an expression of self-worth, is based on a repression of one's sense of vulnerability, which then translates into hostility towards others. The most violent men are those with the deepest fears of those their own impotence. Training in nonviolence must be based on spiritual or personal development and empowerment of the self. An empowered self will not accept its own degradation or that of others. I think that's true. I think that's true. Well, there are some issues I said we would talk about. Let me lay out a few, and then let's talk about them. When we say the issues of learning and the issues of male and female learning together. One, I think, is an issue of power. And many of you have read Women's Reality, Ann Wilson Schaaf, and if you haven't, it's here. I'm sure it's here in the library as well. And she puts so well the whole concept of one up, one down. So it is very hard that for women it is easier to be on an equal footing. You watch a women's group serving a meal at church. They can do it without someone being boss. They really can. Or again, in our women's group at seminary, some male professors try to figure out, one thing, how I can be with other women and the professor's student role doesn't have to get in the way. Can't figure that out. one of them thinks I'm Mother Superior, and they say, she's not Mother Superior to us. She's woman with us. And then we're in the classroom, it's professor-teacher. There's an interchangeability of role that isn't based on identity. So in the middle of a meeting, we have shared leadership. Toss, you know, the leadership to someone else without it demeaning our identity, without having to go one up, one down. And it is hard for me to conceive of, listen to the language I use, huh? It's hard for me to conceive of the what has been traditionally the concept of male one up, one down. And you see, much of our education is based on that. If you're up, the other one has to be down. And the other day we talked about competitive in that sense of my winning at the expense of someone's losing. Ann Wilson Schafe gives this marvelous example of being on the telephone. Some of you know this from the book. Being on the telephone. She's a counselor, and she was on the telephone with a man who was whom she hadn't met before. And Ann's husband came home, and she was, I guess it was a wall telephone, and she was kind of like this. What's going on? And she says, I'm trying to go under a man who keeps wanting to go under me. That in a sense, she was trying to carry on a conversation at a peer level of adult to adult. And if he couldn't be above her, he had to be beneath her. And then she'd have to get beneath that. And the whole kind of logistics of that is interesting. It's based on a concept that there's only so much power. Think about this in relationship to global events. There's only so much power. And if somehow you have some power, that means I have less. That sounds a lot like the arms race too, doesn't it, huh? And she says, for women, and she's come to these conclusions through many, many sessions, hours of women describing their own experience instead of putting it in terms of what they think the male world says it should be. She says, for women, power is a whole different thing. It is a sense in which if I have power and you have power, that means that there's more power. And that makes sense to me. That somehow just makes sense. There's a sense of empowerment, teaching as empowerment. And for me, that's a very strong mode of teaching. Teaching as empowerment so that everyone can grow up to be fully who they are. And that doesn't make me less. That doesn't take away power from me as a professor. And it works. It really works. There's also the concept of relationship and product. Again, for males have been socialized that product is important, and for women, relationship is. I think we're coming to the sense that we must deal with relationship. How much production of arms is not going to solve our problem. The whole relationship thing is a strong issue that will take all of our energies to be about together. But think how many times relationship issues are left to women to work out. Now, today we have a number of men here, but often when there's a topic on male and female, the women should work it out and tell the men how they've worked it out. If they've learned how to deal with relationships, the women can take care of then doing it. The men will do the more productive manufacturing of things in our society. The other concept is one I've already alluded to, and that is mutuality of learning. That somehow we are able to really be on the same level in a mutuality. And for the Christian concept, I think, again, that's a matter of belief. We are often not on the same level. Another person may have more intelligence than I, but it's a matter of belief that we are brothers and sisters and all members of the body, and one part, even though they think they are not, and I is not less than, you know, that whole section. It's a matter of belief that I can learn from you and that you can learn from me. Once that belief is held, have you seen communities really, you know, take hold and go to it? In a sense, that's what we experience, I think, here at Holden Village. In a sense that we are able to have a mutuality of learning. A mutuality of roles and an interdependence of roles. It is fascinating to me. In Dubuque, you know, it's a 60,000 people community. The president of the seminary can be servant at communion, while the custodian at the seminary can be president of the congregation. That interchangeability of roles, of power relationships, because it's not based on identity, is exciting to me. When somehow our roles are all tied up with identity, there is no way that I can be less than in another situation, because I will be diminished. So mutuality of learning, which to me, when those terms we've had on the board the other day, is really true andragogical learning, or anthropological learning of adult to adult. One other barrier to women and men being learners together, I think, is that I think women know more about a man's world than men know about a women's world. And the best way that I can put that is that it is, well, I said a little while ago about the secretness of women doing things together and that that's off-bounds place for a true man. But also, you think in black-white terms of oppressor-oppressed, and I think the analogy works, that the black slave on the plantation knew more about what was going on in the big house than the white plantation owner knew what was going on in the slave shack. For survival, the black had to know what was going on in the white world. Okay, if they're going to survive in a white world, and that's a whole other question, of course, we've gone through historically, or should we go separate ways? But again, for survival, women have had to learn how to make it in a man's world if they were about to do it, where a man gets no points at all for learning how to make it in a woman's world. In fact, it's degrading. So that has put us out of kilter as learners from one another. It would be interesting to hear your experience on that. The last thing is on experience itself. Experience has also often been devalued, and factual learning is highly valued. Technical learning, product learning, defend this thesis learning, define your terms. Define your terms. You can't talk to me unless you define your terms, so I can shoot down your terms. That kind of, pardon me if I come from that world. that kind of learning, you see, denies experience. That's merely your experience. You can't talk out of experience. Well, all of history is experience. Every theological precept has come from experience. I mean, what, Luther, huh? He didn't just think up those things in the middle of the night and define his terms. Come from experience. Experiential, I have a chapter in here on experiential learning and the power of it and some appropriate uses of it. I think experience needs to be tested because I am not God and my experience is not valid for everyone. This is the way it is. Please believe my learning because this is my experience. You will now do it this way. No, but experience is tested by other experience. Experience is tested by other experience and somehow together. Using that as well as fact quotes, which is a capsule account of some other experience, that together can help us grow. Okay, with that, let me ask, what is your experience? What is your experience on any of these issues? Today I've gone on at greater length than I have the rest of the week. And if some of you want to grab hold of some of the things I said earlier, fine. Just jump in at any place on your experience of men and women as learners together. Yes, please.
One of the things that just kind of strikes me right off the top is that I do some vocational counseling work with teenagers and some job placement and that kind of thing. And there's a young man that I have been working with who is going to be going into, has been doing some things at the daycare center and is going to be taking some courses in child development. And if he completes the program, which is a 2-year program, he is going to be the first person who has ever gone through the program who is male. And the people that I talked to and asked some questions about that before he enrolled were just really surprised that he was going to do that. Asked me all kinds of questions about whether or not he would be comfortable in that setting and how he would react to it. He really needed to check all of that out. And he had no qualms about it, and his family was very supportive of it and thought that was really neat, but he was experiencing, and so was I, some really kind of uncomfortable feelings from the institution that he was going to be attending.
That might be enough to wash a guy out. Maybe he feels pretty confident to begin with, but then everybody doubts it. The support is really important, I think, for men. One of my sons who's here in Holden Village is a marvelous babysitter. The other one isn't at all. They have different gifts. But it's been delightful to me that that has not been challenged. And he said, I'm going babysitting tonight. That would not have been true in my generation. For a boy to go babysitting would not have been. Some other things.
Interesting on that point. So much depends upon the ultimate goal. If that boy said, I want to be a child psychologist.
A single
way up here.
Way up there. He could have gone through there and nobody would have.
You can be a cook if you're a chef. That's hard. Is that hard? I mean, it must be hard for men. It must really be hard.
Well, it struck me while you were talking that it seems, you know, you consider the roles that society has put on men and women, that society has perhaps been kinder to women. It almost sounded, as you were talking, that women had the more positive values and men had the more negative values. And I'm wondering whether that's actually a fact. If that's what you were trying to say, or was that just the way it came to me?
Well, how did it come to some of the rest of you? What do you think? Who's had it better off? Huh? And that's a crass way of saying it. Yeah, John.
Nothing's kind of better off, but I do believe in the whole of society, cross-sex possibilities for female have been much larger than cross-sex possibilities for the male. So in the sense of the freedom of a child, and at least up into adulthood where power comes in, but it's the female that's had far more freedom, and it may be evident by the heart attack ratio of male to female in the earlier ages and the marketplace and the force that his whole identity is with work. I mean, a male that does not have a labor to tell you what his laboring task is, and that in that sense it seems to me that the female in a lot of ways has had a greater freedom, particularly if she knew in her heart she was great.
Maybe a healthier position at great cost. And I think also at great cost to the society. Any time in a society when half of the people are said to be this and the other half this, when their gifts intermingle, I think it's a costly division, just as white-black is a costly division.
Cost to both sides.
Cost to both, and to the whole. And to the whole. Because there are a lot of men. Well, one of the reasons I finally sought ordination, I'd been in ministry for about 17 years before I sought ordination, was that I thought there should be some men who should be freed not to be pastors. And there's some women who should be freed to be pastors. And like in any field, some men who should be freed to not be engineers. They really want to be a florist or, you know, whatever. So great cost in that way.
Might be the female can be a tomboy, but the male can't be a sissy.
Well, yeah. I mean, a boy cannot put on a skirt unless you're a pastor. But, I mean, well, and you see how... Yeah, that's one of the problems with that, and we'll talk a little bit about that next week when we talk about American civil religion, is that the church, if it gets in the privatized sector, the feminization, you know, of the clergy, which happened, you know, in our history 100 years ago or so, that it's doubly hard for a man then. So you've got to assert your manhood. But how many of you growing up, you couldn't, I mean, if you wore a skirt, it was, mother or dad made sure you didn't put that on again. And you got named as a tomboy if you're a girl, but you were able to learn as a tomboy, at least for a while. So you're able to cross over in learning. Some other things.
I don't think there's that much crossover from men coming into women's fields or doing women's things as much as I'd like to be seeing it now, especially in careers and that sort of thing. I think that's a lot because women have the low-paying jobs still, the secretaries and the teachers and that sort of thing. So that's why it's not happening. Where I do see the cross, a skirt, I love it.
Are
on those real necessary things like Joanne, we've been talking about singlehood all this week, and there's a lot of men out there that are in a single position and they're finally learning to cook and things like that, those survival things that I think in the past they still would have had scrambled eggs or something. Now that's acceptable and slowly we're getting there. Thank goodness I don't want to be single.
It's marvelous for me to see around here, and I see it other places as well. The gentle, firm, I like those words together, the gentle, firm parenting that is going on with so many daddies in this place, as well as mommies. And, that just kind of feels good. I mean, it just kind of takes a lot of burden off. Some other
I'm in a group of four potters and three weavers and a chiropractic artist and a watercolorist. And a man entered into the group. We work very harmoniously. He entered in the group and confirmed my fears that the worst thing that could happen to the group. And it's a real stress point for me. I can tell the group, one of the organizers of it. And here now, potters are labeled competitive, feisty people. And I never thought of myself because of his site, labeling us as that. And we are always using old methods of doing things. We're only been in operation a year and a half. and it takes a tremendous amount of energy to handle this stuff. I'm going to have it my way, you old woman. And it really is, it takes awful lot of creative talent from the group. We use so much energy in trying to defend ourselves from these accusations, you might say, at the same time, almost really provoking us by our hostile reactions become.
When it says you are. We live up to our name. Let's talk for a few minutes about male, female, entering other each groups, because I'm concerned about some how-tos when we go back home to our own Christian community, congregations, or whatever communities we're part of. And I think this we could do some helpful talking with one another. I think it is very hard for a man to enter a women's group. What roles are open to a man entering a woman's group? And maybe men, some of you can say that. Have you any of you been the only man in a women's group? And what roles are open to you to play? Has that ever been your experience?
Well, I started aerobics and gender studies quite a few years ago. Quite often, I'm at home, and it's very difficult for me to do that sometimes.
How so? Can you describe how it's difficult? It would be helpful for us.
Well, I just kind of feel out of place or I'm doing something feminine.
Yeah.
That I should do.
So those old tapes, so I shouldn't be doing this.
How about if a man does something feminine, but and other women find this out, they make the wife feel guilty because this man is doing something that is thought of as being feminine. What I'm speaking about is when I went to work, and I was also training for criminal avoidance in it, and I threatened Jerry, I'm going to quit unless I get some help at home. And so the thing he said is, what do you hate doing the worst? And I said, ironing. Well, he'd never had iron in his hand his whole life, but eventually he learned how to iron. Good. But when I would happen to mention something where I was working,
making him less than masculine, making him less than human.
And put a guilt trip on me.
Yeah. I have that envy. Okay. Envy because my husband does so much. He's retired now. And wow, I come home and he'll say, you just go sit down and relax, and then I'll have dinner on the table and a man. He just is great. And I go to school and I say, wow.
That's why you look like such a healthy person. Yeah, I think there's probably a mixture that you want to see.
Well, my husband had an experience yesterday that was interesting. My older daughter wanted to do the courthouse dolls down in the craft center downstairs here. And I had planned to do something else, and she is under 14 and couldn't go alone. And so Mark said, well, I'll go with you because he had to have an adult. We got only 10 people can sign up. So there were 9 women, and then my daughter and this man. And he said he couldn't believe the looks he got when he walked in. Everybody else kind of briefly introduced themselves, first name, and that was it. And Jenny did that, Mark did. And he said, everybody just geared everything to him because, he was the odd one. And he said somebody even, made some real mention, wanted him to introduce himself again and tell more about him. They didn't do that to any of the other women. But he said, boy, people would come walking through there and just do double takes and stare at him and look, and he said, boy, he felt really strange
We do.
Really weird. And he enjoyed himself. He was having a good time, and they got a cute cornhouse doll on the deal. But
yeah, but it's, this is, I think, it's important to talk about. Glad
for it. Well, I was there. And see, I didn't feel that one bit.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, you know.
We're going to have different recordings of the same experience.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure everybody didn't. But
it's like the four gospels.
They got these strange looks.
Well, it's interesting, though, and there are different perceptions of what's going on. I mean,
well,
we all
I'm
know
sure
that.
He felt
I do want to say a couple of things, though. One, there's a book called In But Still Out by Elizabeth Ferdazzi. Some of you have read. I see you shaking heads. Very helpful one. A historical thesis on Presbyterian women, and reading that helps me as a Lutheran then look at my story and say, oh, yeah, same thing going on. And her thesis is that women participate in their own co-optation. That during the mid-19th century, women were very powerful in missionary movement in the Presbyterian Church and home missions and had all their own money. Money is power, adult, all that business. And then all of a sudden the women, you see, got noticed. They couldn't be trivialized anymore. They got powerful, money, whatever. Their little missionary efforts weren't just little dinky things over here. So the church wanted to take it over. Okay, and the women let the church participate in their own co-optation. And her second part of the book tells about the Christian education movement in the Presbyterian Church, which was primarily female. Male came in, again, participate in their own co-optation. If the men are in the group, they must become the leaders. We must defer to them. And men may not want to. I mean, to shed some of the leadership responsibility, and that's heavy. But women sometimes participate in it and defer to or participate in co-optation. A couple of years ago, we had a group on campus that had been Wartburg women for a number of years, okay, and have been all the women, staff, wives, student wives, faculty wives, and so on. Then there were women seminary students, you see. The thing is upset. What are you going to do now? You see, you have women over here in the men's world. Does this mean the women's world has no value? Or when women could be ordained, does that mean the deaconess community of which I come has no value? I stayed a deaconess. I am still a deaconess, living the ambiguity, because I have not gone up to higher things. I am carrying out my servanthood, diaconia, in the ministry of word and sacrament. I think we have to, for all, live that ambiguity. Well, what happened in this Wartburg women's group, that some of the husbands of women students said it ought to be a group for us. It should be a group of all of the spouses, because the students all have something in common. How about a spouse group, you know, that has something in common? And that's important, because a lot of men who are going to be husbands of women clergy, what role do you play? If you're the pastor's husband is a weird role. We haven't figured out yet. So it became open to men and women. So then the crucial question, we have men in there, what's going to happen? Now, can you come together as in a mutual way as adults in a learning community? Well, the first year, one man came once and wanted to really, he kind of had to assert himself and kind of have all the ideas. He only came once. Wasn't going to work. A couple of other men came and really kind of found their niche and worked in their way, and it really worked well. The next year, there were no men in the group. Last year, there was a couple of men again. But it's very hard. I think that's been harder for men in the spouses group than, and it's hard enough, but been harder even than women in the male student body. Some other comments you might have. Or some other how-tos, some other things that help us to know how to go about this that might give us some clues. We can sure use some. Yeah. I'd be curious if some of the rest of you find this. You said a moment ago it's not changing as quickly as you might like. This afternoon in Joanne's group at 4, blue and pink booties, we'll probably talk some more about that. But is that your experience? I think in Dubuque, and certainly in New Haven, it was, in fact, maybe even a reaction, because particularly with the unemployment and a lot of men not having identity and job, increase in family violence, I am going to raise my boy to be a man. There's almost a kind of backlash to that I've seen. How has it been for you? Do you think we're over the hump? Do you think our kids have some freedoms that we didn't have? And witches, and that's very New Testament.
And that depends on the couple. There are many, I mean, it's a personality.
Depends on gifts, doesn't it?
Women.
Depends on gifts.
But society's pressure at this point is for me, the traditional homemaker, to be dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm. And that,
I'm feeling that very much now that my youngest child is leaving home.
Yes, shouldn't you now be
shouldn't
going
I
on
be
to higher
productive.
Things? Yes, yeah.
Going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awfully important because the other day we've been talking all week about vocatio and learning because I think the two go together. And yesterday we did some exercise on discerning growing edges of vocatio. And it may mean, up on the board we had remain. It may mean to remain in what I am doing. And we need affirmation of that. That may be a step ahead to remain in what I'm doing. And it is a matter of gifts. It really is a matter of discerning gifts. There's a kind of freedom that comes from that. It is not freedom to be pushed into new roles that aren't going to be the good ones. That's probably inevitable in the midst of a revolution, and we're living kind of in the midst of a revolution. But we need to get beyond that to real freedom. Over here, somebody had a hand.
How do you overcome this fear of like my husband is not a leader, he's a follower. How do you get him out of that? He always wants to be in the background. He never wants to be speak out.
Maybe he's gifted to be a follower. Does he feel content that way?
He must. He always led a very sheltered life from childhood.
Sure.
And when we're in a crowd, I'll turn around and he's behind me. He'll never join the group.
Does that work for you? Sounds like it may be more uncomfortable for you. Okay, yeah, it's more uncomfortable for you.
I would want him to join more.
Now, that may have to do with other things too, such as his own comfortableness in a group, which is maybe... But for you to make a decision and to make it firmly and joyfully with his assent is not necessarily a bad thing. Talking about it, that negotiating that is awfully important. I think it must be very wearying for some men who really prefer to be a follower to be put in the leadership mold whenever they're in a group with male female. Talk about it with them. Likewise, many women go to great means to avoid being a leader. And then what we often do is lead from the sidelines in a manipulative way, which is not a helpful mode for anyone. Verdesi in that book talks again about power. Power is the ability to help make something happen. It doesn't mean it has to do somebody in. And women have not been comfortable with assuming power, direct, accountable leadership. Whether it is in buying groceries, you are exerting power, economic power. As a consumer in our society, you know, whatever ways that we're exerting our power, it's making something happen. And to be able to do that with directness and accountability is going to be important for women. Otherwise, men aren't going to be able to figure out where we're at. That saw some head shaking. Some more. Put some words to those head shaking. Okay.
I work in a paper mill where in the last 10 years there have been a lot of women integrated in traditional men's mm-hmm. jobs, and it seems to work fairly well. I think that there are a lot of opportunities open for them that weren't before, if you consider that an opportunity. Originally, women only worked in a one part of the mill. It was an inside job, and it was mm-hmm. physically not too demanding. So they demanded equal rights. Now they have to compete among all the hard, dangerous jobs. Mm-hmm. So they've lost some freedom, and they've gained some freedom. I sometimes wonder if they've got the best of the two worlds, because before they were in a protected situation. If they worked there, they've got to go right directly to that department, whereas now they have to compete with all the jobs.
We're in an interesting place, also our time-wise, aren't we? We're in an interesting place, and let me just say a couple things about that, because any kind of change does not come easy, and there's resistance to change. When women enter certain jobs, and I've seen statistics on this, the tendency is then to make that job less if the women cross over in greater numbers. Even in legislative positions, state legislative positions, when women get in greater numbers, the salary across the board goes down. Another way is to, okay, then let's put them out there in danger. Let's see if they can make it. They said to me, you go give that speech and let's see if we can shoot you down. Okay, what are you going to do with that, you know? That kind of situation, very, very difficult. And that's where we need each other. And where we need each other is advocates. There are times at which my brothers are the ones that have to speak because they're going to be heard. And there are times in which the only one that can set free the discussion is if I speak. Because the oppressed also in some ways holds the oppressor in bondage when there's an awkward moment. We need each other as advocates, whether it's on the job or in a committee or in whatever. We also need times for men to be able to be alone. When the men came to our group and said, we want a group, and we just blessed them and bought the beer and pretzels and said, go meet. It was tempting to say, we'll meet with you. We weren't ready to meet together yet. They needed a chance to meet together and say stuff to each other they hadn't known what to say before. At the same time, we've got to work at new ways of being together, all at the same time. Committee work in church bodies. I'm not so inclined to say let's give up women's groups totally, because I don't think we're at the point yet where we really are at that mutuality point. I think we need a lot of working together to find out the joy of partnership. And some of you have experienced that with men and women working together. It is absolutely marvelous, that partnership of empowerment together. At the same time, I think we need places, certainly in the church, we need men to be able to meet together, not just to cut the lawn. One church in Kansas had a men's group. It was a retreat, which they really dealt with feelings and real stuff. And they said, it was so good, let's do it again. They said, well, what should we do next year? The same stuff we did last year. We need to do more of it. We're not ready to move on yet to course number two. We have not been allowed to be adult learners with real stuff. And that's important. Before you go, and we're not done, but before you go, can I give an advertisement. I don't know if it's allowed in Holden Village or not, but I brought along something that's dear to me to share with you, and if some of you would like a copy, you can have one. They cost $3.50. A year ago, when it became obvious that there were enough women at Wartburg Seminary that you could no longer make sure who was in the room and who wasn't, there were so many there we couldn't keep them in our head anymore, we thought this is precisely the time that oral history ought to become written history. Because someone is going to tell the story of the first women theological students. And maybe the women ought to tell their own story from their experience rather than somebody telling it about them. So we set about to see how many there were. We thought there must be about 50 students now, maybe about 50 graduates. Turned out we found every name, even all the women who'd been certified by Wartburg but had gone to other seminaries. We found 140 names. In 6 weeks' time, we gathered 125 stories. I don't know how we did that, but we did it and wrote them up. And this is the story of the first women at Wartburg Seminary. We named it, and the women came, 100 and more. We didn't gather the data and make a statistical analysis. We wrote the stories and put them in chronological order, together with a history of Wartburg, which until that time had been a typically male history. We found some women in the history of Wartburg after whom the refectory was named, that no one knew their stories. And then we started out with 1970, the first woman who came, 1971, the next woman. Found out these two had never been on campus at the same time because of internship and so on. One of the male students, when this was published, said, why didn't you put the names in alphabetical order? That's the way you should do it. And we said, no, we put it in chronological order. Because as you read, you get to the back of the book, and you find women who thought about being pastors when they were in eighth grade. In 13 years, that much had changed. We also found that women were all sorts. They were not all radical feminists. They were of every political persuasion. They were single, married, divorced, widowed. They traveled miles and miles. We thought about calling it Pioneer Priests. But if any of you would like this, we also got money from the women to publish the book ourselves and printed 600 books. They're all gone. So this spring we took a second venture of faith and printed 400 more. And most of them are now gone. We found it's not just important for us, but also for congregations, for pastors, for church libraries, for women's groups, for men's groups, to read this and to think about themselves and their own stories as they read this story. I'll talk to you.